Welcome to the Mock Stars Podcast. I am Menace, one of your hosts, and I'm here with a special guest. We've got Tordeth in the house. What's up, Justin?
Hi, everybody.
He's back on the show, honorary Mock Star Tordeth, back with us. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by liking, subscribing, and ringing that bell for more notifications on YouTube. You can also find us on all podcasting platforms. Leave us a 5-star review to make us look super duper cool. You can also support us on Patreon by becoming an official Pepperhead. You can have your name turned Dr. Pepper Red on the Discord server for $3 a month. We also have a few additional tiers. We have the $5 tier, the Cherry Vanilla Pepperhead tier. We also have the 2-liter tier for $10 a month, and we also have the Mockstars Dr. Pepper Lounge access for $50 a month. Gets you a free hat and 3 entries into each of our bi-weekly giveaways, like Ravenlift. So, all goes towards the show and helping us make this a better place for all of our listeners. Today, on the show, we're going to talk about Magic. That's the goal. We're just going to talk about Magic and a few things about CDH. Really kind of the atmosphere of what tournaments are looking like, deck building, where things are headed. Justin, you and I have been talking for a while. We've had a few ideas about episodes we've wanted to do and collab and get a third voice on and stuff like that with where CDH currently stands and what we could do to make it better. You know, there's all these ideas we've been tossing around. So really just one thing at a time, I guess. We can jump in wherever we want to, man. It is a public pool and there's nobody hanging out by the edge. We can cannonball in, we can dive in, we can use the freaking the diving boards, the spring-loaded diving boards if we want to. All these things, there are options upon options for us. Access points. There's a slide. We could even slide in, do a loop-de-loop. There's no, you can't stop, you know, when you go down the slide, you can't put your arms out and stop and wait for your buddy to hit you in the back. You can't do that though, but all these access points for the conversation.
Well, we do everything with safety. Magic is safe.
Yes.
Play Magic safely. Live your life safely. Don't run near the pool.
Yeah, no running. No running.
Mm-mm.
No.
Mm-mm.
Nope, 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 nope.
So, yeah, let's get into the tournament side of it first. So, I'm still baffled at how much of a splash that long-ass game went. 10, 11 hours.
Oh, that
3 to 4 hours of talking.
It'll live on forever. That's a game of legend.
Well, like, I was at a tournament last weekend, and they still made jokes about it when they were doing the player meeting at the front of it. Like, oh, make sure you're filling all your time wisely, 80-minute this, and, you know, can't be here all night, can't do that 11-hour thing. If that's the case, what are we doing as a community to fix that type of thing? So that would be let's bat some things back and forth and talk about once we leave Swiss. So we hit our 80 minutes. I like that we're not in turns anymore. We just go to end of turn, no extra 10 minutes. Great. We have finished Swiss. We're into our semis. We're into our finals. Regardless if we're cutting to top 10, top 16, top 32, depending on the tournament size. What do we need to do to change the aspect of this tournament structure and make it so everybody, TOs and the judges included, can go on and have a life outside of the tournament, get to bed on time, drive home safely so we're not driving at 2:00 in the morning?
Yeah, I have a million things I'm sure that the more we could talk about what we could do to positively change CDH and I'm curious to get your opinion on a couple of things, but yeah, just starting right off the bat with your time and how you value your time and how we create a structure. This is ultimately the issue I see with CDH in TDH, most, just TDH, right? CDH at, you know, at the con or whatever. Those games can go on for however long. As long as everyone's still having a good time, awesome, whatever. As long as it's an engaging experience. The TDH format, though, what I will say is that it needs far more structure and rules implementation. Like, there needs to be a razor's edge. There can't be so much freedom in how players are able to navigate or politicize the game to extend the clock. Or, like, this was the thing that I pitched a long time ago, and I want to get your feedback on it too, is we need a way to penalize players, but we also need what I call them were tokens, right? Or
yeah,
like
correct.
Political tokens, right? Where you get, let's say you get three a game, and you, like, as a player is going throughout their turn, if you're not interacting with the stack and you're just trying to have a conversation to sway a player, to change their mind, to get something to go your way, right? To convince them that this is not in their best interest, what they're about to do. You redeem one of your tokens, and that gives you something physical and something of value. It's like a timeout in football. Like, if you follow like football or basketball or whatever, you know how valuable these timeouts can be. They're momentum breakers. They can help you reset. They can help you insert new information into certain scenarios to help, create an advantage for you. So, like, right now, there's no policing of it, whatever. That 11-hour game, there was one guy who, I think, after all the interviews of all the players who were involved and stuff like that, they kept saying, this one guy, for 5 of the 11 hours, was just stopping the game to talk. Like, it was like he was just trying to create political scenarios that would benefit him, but that slowed the game down, like, so much. So, you get three of these tokens.
Do I give them to the judge, or do I give them to my other players?
You present them to the table, and then that is redeemed, you know? And then if someone tries to redeem a fourth one or whatever, or they don't have any left, and they're like, hey, you call judge and you say slow play.
So to your point, then, in this scenario, we'll call it four. Cool. Great. So you get four of these.
Well,
it's not that I can give active player one and now they have a fifth. It's just gone forever. Is that what you're trying to propose to me right now?
In every game, you get three, right? And it's like, it's like calling a timeout when you don't have a timeout is when you get a penalty, right? So that's it. We also have to have judges who have teeth. So, like, a judge coming over and, like, being like, yeah, I don't know, I didn't see what happened. Like, please explain the scenario to me or whatever. But, like, if someone tries to call a timeout when they don't have a timeout, it's a penalty, right? So that's, you also have to be able to give your judges teeth to be able to enforce those things. Now, what the rule structure says in, like, the rule book you would have to write to penalize those players, yet to be determined. But, like, if you are slow playing without redeeming a token, right, or if you make a mistake or whatever, and a judge is called, a judge can also take one of your tokens as a penalty if you have any left. If you don't have any tokens left, let's say you get a loss of turn, right? You have no tokens left and you commit a penalty. Loss of turn. You might as well have just lost the game. Congratulations. But that would also control, like, disincentivize players from inserting themselves into situations that would otherwise slow the game down. It would prevent, I think it would shorten games and allow you to still hit that 80 minute time, and that way everyone, every round can, like, flow seamlessly. And then at the end of the game, you can also look back and be like, no, I had one token left, I should have used it at this moment. You know, it's an additional piece to the game that allows you to, like, you can look back on it and strategically use it, you know?
Right. So. And I have no problem trying things out like this. I guess I have two thoughts on that one. First would be, at what level do we start to implement new changes to the tournament circuit structure, if it were me, you do it at the bronze levels. Just anything 16 or less, we're going to cut to a top four at most. Your points towards the end of the year are less affected if things go awry, and you can casually try things out in different regions. So
yep.
I think in the Northeast, as an example, we could try this out. In the Pacific Northwest, we could try 90-minute turns instead of 80-minute turns. In the California region, we could try different things. There is a high abundance of top-level players in the Columbus, Ohio area, and you could try something else out there, maybe at your silver and gold levels, right, to see how these things go. So I'm not opposed to it, but I think Atlas said it right at one point to me when we were talking about this, where if you take away the social aspect of the game and the ability to politic, then it just turns into a 1v1 format. And then that leads to me to kind of like my 1B point of, if we have Wizards taking a major role in creating content for Commander, and this is now the moneymaker for them, and it is hands down the most popular format of Magic currently, just with the presence online in all of the content that's out there, I think we need to get an official MTR from Wizards to come through, not just card bans, not just bracket structure, but let's arm these judges with the ability to have teeth. Even something as simple as the past 6 months in any tournament that I've been into, hey, guys, this is a family-friendly environment. Please don't swear. Any swearing will be met with a turn skip. And not once have I seen it enforced. Terrible language. But if I'm at a family-friendly event and a family-friendly shop, I don't swear when I go down to Gabby's to play, because that's an environment where it's been cultivated that you are not allowed to do that. So let's make this a place where we are obeying the shop rules and allow the judge to do that. If they get up and say they're going to do X, Y, and Z, then damn it, they need to follow through with that as well. And we're not going to be, quote, afraid of our judges to uphold anything if they can't uphold I don't want a judge to only uphold the CR. I want the IPG side of it too. I want unsporting conduct. I want the slow play in there. I want every aspect of what it takes to be an L1, L2, L3 plus at these events. And that's how we're going to affect changes there as well.
Yeah. Here's the thing. We are ultimately, what people are wanting out of this, like, is exactly what we're talking about. They want structure. One, what we're trying to create with TEDH, and like, this is what Wizards should be like working on, and having the CFP, the Commander Format Panel and stuff like that, like, is whatever. I don't really care. I don't really put much thought into it. Like, once they said they weren't going to make any banning changes or anything like that for a full year, I was like, oh, okay, so they're as good as our government right now. They take vacations whenever they want, and they just don't want to talk about these things for a year. So yeah, here we go. It's the Wild West. It's lawless nature. All these cards that they're releasing for the next year are just perfect. It doesn't matter. So their influence on this whole thing is minimal at best, and they need to put more effort into like creating structure for this so that players can feel like they have a fighting chance at the table, and they have to treat it like it's a sport. Like, this is an e-sport. Like, it's pretty much an e-sport, right? You're going to come in, you're not, like, and you need that rule structure to be present, like giving your judges teeth. You need to have referees present to uphold the integrity of the game. That's what referees are for in every other sport. Like, there are people like in esports who are watching the game happen, and when a penalty is committed or whatever, the game is paused or whatever, and then they interact and they say, you've been warned, or here's a warning, you've been earned, or you're penalized. So like, that would be like where, if I was Wizards of the Coast or I was involved with Wizards of the Coast, that's what I would be pitching 100% of the time. Is like, hey, these guys are serious. Like, these guys are serious about like this crucible of Magic the Gathering and TDH, where they want to grind and grind and grind and receive accolade and win tournaments and build their reputation. And so why are we not meeting them in the middle with a rule structure that can allow for fair competitive gameplay? So that's where I would be. Yeah, if I was part of Wizards of the Coast, is just being like, hey, we need to put in some work here, because it is not just going to survive on its own. Like, it,
right.
People will get into grinding and they will go in, but it is exhausting without any like reward structure or anything like that. It's exhausting, and it can definitely wear you out. Now, here's something I'm going to pitch you. This is something that I've been thinking a lot about, because like deck construction and stuff like that is obviously a big part about CDH, and all the top decks have existed at the top for forever. And
your Pantheon.
Yeah, it's always Blue Farm. It's always Sisay. It's always, you know, there are very few decks that can insert themselves. You know, it's always Kinnan, you know, and that can insert themselves and really stay there.
Sure.
So like, I guess what I would, and this is sort of like an episode topic that I brought up a long time ago with like C3DH, where you build into tier three. I think it would be important for the future of CDH to, and this is a stretch, but you could eliminate the ban list if everything that was on the ban list currently was considered a game changer, and you could only have three game changers in your deck as a deck building restriction. And that would give
be a little much though, right? Like,
you know, that's just, it's a stretch, but let's say even if we're not even talking about the ban list stays banned, have a restriction of three game changers, because then Wizards of the Coast can now have more control over the sporting aspect of it, right?
So my TEDH decks would be what they'd consider bracket three right now, and we're not allowed to ascend from that, is what you're trying to pitch to me right now?
Yes.
I don't disagree with it. I saw something recently where the spirit of the format for Commander is no tutors. You ban all tutors, everything, et cetera, et cetera. And I personally think that's a little extreme, but if we're going to take to the actual spirit of the format, then how do I enforce the no tutors, let it draw what it's supposed to be, start building in redundancy, really digging through that scryfall at the end of it? What does my average seven look like if I'm not able to do any of this tutoring, right? It's a bad example, but okay, if I can't have a vampiric tutor, then I'm going to start using cards like Grim Tutor, which we've been told along the way are quote unquote objectively bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start to really explore the deck building aspect of it. That would for sure shake up the meta.
Because then you're just not allowed, you know, to, like, you get to choose your lines, right? And while, yes, there is that, like, level of decision-making in the deck-building process, the decks that are at the top can choose every line, and they choose the most efficient line, and they can get there either through their commander's abilities or card advantage that their commanders present or whatever, but a lot of it are just generic good stuff piles that get there. And this, the wide array, the massive card pool that we have access to right now is leading to almost zero competitive, diversity where it's just always the top, decks, because they just do the thing, and people will just build that deck to give themselves the best chance to win. Like, and I get it. Like, I understand. I get it. If you want to win, and this deck has proven to have this win rate, like, it's going to give you the best chance. Like, I get there are people like that who want to compete in that way or build decks in that way. But I do think that, like, the way it currently stands, we're looking at a very stagnant format that has zero rules enforcement. Well, not like zero rules enforcement, but zero behavioral enforcement.
No metadata analysis on any of what's going on, like they do with the 60 card format.
Yes, exactly. And like you said, with Wizards of the Coast taking control, or like being responsible now for the Commander format, like, these are all things that I think would go towards improving engagement. Like, not only that, you know, like, for the community and stuff like that. Like, hey, you have, you know, your deck building, or you're just playing Commander, right? And you're like, oh, I want to make my deck stronger. I want to make my deck stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. That is the journey of being a Magic player, is you learn the game, and then you slowly get better and understand more things, and you upgrade your decks little by little by little. And then once you hit your ceiling, right, then it's, or like, once you hit the ceiling of like CDH and expanding your card knowledge to the massive pool, and then understanding how things interact on a layers level or state base level or priority level, you know, it's like, then, like, you need somewhere to go. And right now, Wizards of the Coast is just leaving it to some third party guys, like event organizers like that. So they have all this potential at their fingertips for CDH and the massive community that it is now. And from what I've seen at Magic Cons, like, it's, you know how, like, when you go to your kid's kindergarten, you know, and like the way they're teaching your kids, oh yeah, this is for babies. Like, yeah, I'm way past this. Like, you're going to kindergarten as an adult and you're like, yeah, I think I'm beyond this. Like, that's the way they're teaching CDH right now at Magic Con, is like, they just let anyone jump in, and then they baby you through the program. And they're like, that's what CDH is. And I'm like, no,
it's not.
Not really. Like, they're like, well, you have to decide if you want to do this or do that, or give them this option. And yes, there are all these divergent paths that you can walk in CDH. Your deck should have the options to be able to walk them. But you can't teach it like it's a children's game, or you can't teach it like it's this simple thing that anyone can enter either. But it's like, I don't know, they need to be a little bit more rigorous in their preparing future CDH players for what it is.
Yeah, they need to bring back the Guru program and the summer program, but specifically for, even just call it bracket 3 EDH. The pre-cons are great, but we don't have any incentive for the high level players of the area to go through and take on a group of 8 people. There's no card support for that. If they spend a summer, there's a reason those Guru lands are so expensive, because they were a select few people were allowed to actually get these cards. They should bring that back, but they're going the opposite direction of that. They axed the judge program even. So,
and we all know that's a mistake.
Agreed. So I do think I wouldn't be opposed to your no ban list. We just get 3, but I still think before we get to that route, we need a little more guidance for new players and bringing them in to really give them a helping hand into what CEDH looks like versus high power kitchen table stuff.
Yeah.
When was the last time you tried to explain priority in the stack in a meaningful way to a player that had never experienced something like that before? They go from, I cast this, and I go straight to combat.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I will say, like, being back home and playing with my original pod and all those guys, and we were playing, like, that's the thing. They don't call it CDH. They call it high-powered. So they know the difference, right? And there are times when something is presented on the stack, like an ad-nos, and they're like, everyone just collectively looks at each other, like, oh, we don't have anything. And it's just like, no. Priority, you know, and like go around the table. Do you pass priority on this? That's like when you need to, like, that's when you start crossing the line into like CDH. It's like, no one reveal information that you don't need to reveal. Like, as priority comes around the table, have the discussion, right? Like,
that's something then that Wizards could do in addition to pumping out cardboard. Put trigger tokens inside the precons. Make sure every single one's got a priority token and a trigger token. And
yeah.
Force the players to look at it and say, what is this? What are triggers?
Ask the right questions.
Correct, because then we can go from playing Magic to playing Magic at its fundamental competitive level and truly understanding how everything interacts.
Yeah, that's like I said, that's when you get to the peak, right? But you don't walk that path until you know what questions to ask, right? And this is like,
sure,
this is like at work for me. Like, if y'all didn't know, I'm in the food industry, I'm a chef. And like, when I'm speaking or when I'm looking for cooks to like take the next step or whatever, like, I'm looking for the guys who ask, what's next, chef? Like, I finished this project, what's next, chef? And eventually you ask what's next, chef, enough to where you know what's next, right? And so, like, that, I guess what I'm getting at with that point is, like, when you're playing Magic, ask why. Like, if you're itching to grow into that player, into to be him or be them, you know, like, ask the questions. Like, you don't understand something, don't just let it slip by you. Just be like, hey, why is that a bad thing? Like, before we implement these political tokens and you have all the time in the world to ask questions, ask them. You know, it's like, that's really like what I implore you as every player out there is, like, ask questions until you don't need to ask questions anymore. And maybe that point never comes. I think every great player still asks questions. So,
well, I'll segue a little bit up there. I'm not going to pat myself on the back and say, oh my God, I'm a great player, but I do play with some of those great players. And I was asking my buddy Kevin recently, I'm goldfishing a Kefka list. And before you yell at me about me playing Grixis, that's fine. It's a Final Fantasy thing. It's not a Grixis thing.
You villain!
So I was goldfishing a hand, and it was like three lands, a Vampiric Tutor, and a rock. And I had the option to either, as I was goldfishing, this turn two is either going to be a Mystic Remora or a Rhystic Study. So I sent the question to him and said, Kevin, you're so much better at playing Grixis than I am. In this situation, is a fish where the non-creature spells cost four and they can't pay for it better, or is the Rhystic Study better? And explain to me why it's better, not just that one of the two of them was better. And his response was something along the lines of the less upkeep later for a higher payout now is going to be better in a game where you expect a Rhystic Study to stick around versus a fish. So if the game plan is to go past turn two or three, those taxes on that Mystic Remora are very real and will long-term put you behind. So if you anticipate that fish isn't going to draw you more than one or two, pay the three mana, get the Rhystic Study, and be done with it.
Yeah.
And that was a phenomenal insight into why this person would tutor for a specific thing versus another. Ask those questions.
Yeah. Even for me, like in that situation, it's like, what turn or like what player am I in turn order? and like, what have the players before me even done? If I'm first in turn order, and this is the like, yeah, I'm like, no one else has cast anything yet. That becomes a really hard question, because then you're like, well, no one's cast anything. There's a decent chance someone's gonna get off to a good start. So this Mystic Remora in one turn cycle might actually provide enough value. But then I'm third in turn order. Someone has already cast two non-creature spells during their first turn. I'm probably not going to get much more out of them for the, you know, for the value of the fish. So yeah, I'm going to go get Rhystic Study. Or do I have Interaction in my hand? Am I able to extend the game? Because then Rhystic Study feels really good right now. Or am I praying to the gods that the fish will get triggered and I'll draw Interaction? Because I think there are bursts of card draw that come from the fish that you don't necessarily see with Rhystic Study, because people can be responsible and pay for it. So yeah, there's a lot that goes into answering that question.
And just simply, what would you do, I think, is the wrong way to go about learning the TEDH aspect of the game. So many people forget to ask why.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in life, just a very important thing to like, don't just go along with the status quo or whatever, like tradition. If you don't know why you're doing it, like, ask why. And then if someone can tell you why they did it, then it's probably a pretty good, you know, it's probably a reason. But if they can't tell you why they did it, it's just that's what they do. It's probably not a good reason behind it. So,
right. Well, let's segue there into something else we were talking about, which is shaking up the meta and deck building.
Yeah.
Right. So great. Everybody knows the Blue Farm's fantastic. I was talking with some friends out west today, and apparently Krark Thras is massive in the Pacific Northwest right now. I personally have only seen it once or twice. Right now, Rog'Sai is really huge again out here. I was talking with our buddy Tyler Myers from the team, and he was telling me Kefka's bad. Well, out here, it's topping tournaments.
That's pretty good.
It's very meta-specific, obviously. But then where do we insert new ideas into these metas to even attempt to try something new? I was getting the feel from some of these players going to the Top Deck Championship in September, and it was, how many decks, what percentage of the meta do you think is going to be Blue Farm and Rog'Sai? And I got back a non-sarcastic 40 to 50%, which, if this is Wizards for Modern and Pioneer and Standard, and 50% of their meta is one deck, they start looking at banning cards.
Yes.
Right? So in that situation, if I know I need to play Blue Farm, we'll just stick there. When am I going to even present a new deck idea and start playing with that, knowing that this is competitive? I need to have some kind of dopamine hit and not just lose 30 games in a row because I want to try something different.
I mean, yeah, that was... like, I think the most recent example of like something that was inserted into the format to shake up metas was probably Nadu, right? Whether it was intentional or not. Like,
yeah.
But then it was just like, oh, now like the 28% of the meta that was Blue Farm was just met with another equal 28% that was Nadu. And so that just diminished. It didn't like help other decks grow or anything like that, or didn't diminish the amount of Blue Farm decks that were being entered. It only increased the amount of Nadu decks that were made. And so it's a very fine
balance. Took away from everything else.
Yes. And so the meta actually got less diverse once Nadu was introduced.
Yeah. So, you had mentioned this most recent episode about how Atali is going ham right now.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that a little bit too, but I would say Lumra is the big, holy smokes, this deck is super good.
Yeah, it slaps.
As the biggest slash, or as biggest splash. But right now, what I'm seeing, and the Pacific Northwest meta is so responsible and so interactive where I'm seeing everywhere else that I've played when I travel for work, you know, play in Texas, California, New York, Florida, and now tournaments in Ohio, we're removing interaction from our decks to get redundancy and win cons. But it's more from players that see this deck wins, don't understand what's in it. They'll get discouraged because it didn't do what they wanted it to do. So they'll cut even more interaction and put more win cons in just to get there. So we're now playing, we're not playing a four player format. We're playing a 1v1v1v1 format. And that's just so remarkable.
That's, yeah, like I have the, my brain works the opposite way. It's like, as soon as I, when I build the deck, I build all those excessive win cons into the deck and I play it, you know, a couple dozen times until I figure out what lines are most effective or efficient. And then I cut the rest and then I put the interaction in. And then if I'm not seeing the results that I want, I cut a little bit more and then I put more interaction in, you know, and then, yeah, so it's a little bit, that's odd for me. That feels a little odd.
And there's nothing wrong with a turbo deck cutting interaction to get there first. The best advice I got from Atlas on how to go from mulling around in the Swiss tables to playing in semis and finals tables was that old school Star City article, Who's the Beatdown? I think everybody going into tournaments and really want to start the grind should read that article.
I'll make sure I put it in the description too for listeners
perfect.
Out there.
Yep. But if your deck is not designed to be the fastest at the table, then you need to adapt in a way to where go second, shut the first deck down, and ensure that they can't get there. But if your deck is not the beatdown, expected to go the fastest and get there first, don't try to get there first. And I think I've been seeing a lot of that. As much as we hated the mid-range hell, irresponsible turbo is just as bad.
Oh yeah, because they just completely boot themselves. They punt themselves out of the game, and that's worse for the ultimate overall outcome of the game than, you know, just like, yeah.
I will also say 9 times out of 10, they do not pay for the heuristic study and then audibly complain about why did we lose to that card and then call for a ban of heuristic study.
Yeah. Like, so I'll read the first paragraph of Who's the Beatdown, and this will give you a good idea of what the article is about, because after this paragraph, the original author, Mike Flores, on January 1st of 1999 is when this article was published. He wrote, "The most common yet subtle and disastrous mistake I see in tournament magic is the misassignment of who is the beatdown deck and who is the control deck in a similar deck versus similar deck matchup. The player who misassigns himself is inevitably the loser." And then he goes on to explain why that is such a powerful statement. So, check out the article, because it will give you perspective on how to approach like the game based on the first, you know, the 7 or the 6 or the 5 that you decide to keep, right? Because the meta is not very diverse at the moment, right? You're going to see a lot of similar decks, even though like Krark Thrass might be the hotness out here in the Pacific Northwest. Like Rog Thrass is still a very similar build and a very similar like deck matchup. So like when you're in those matchups, you got to know that like, hey, yes, they are going to be casting a lot of non-creature instants of sorceries, trying to get that Krark trigger to like pop off for them. But like, they're very similar build to what I am. So I have to know when to take, like when I need to step forward and like know if I'm controlling or if I am the aggressor. And that will ultimately, that will help you decidedly win games more effectively than having them fall into your lap due to, improper sequencing or mistakes made by the other three players at the table. It will feel like a more confident win, and it'll feel like a more well-deserved win when you're able to like identify which role you are designed or that you are meant to fill at the table, you know, given any given situation. So that's what this article will give you the information. What you'll be able to glean from it is like, yeah, I'm the aggressor. Or no, I, based on what I have and what I see at the table, I am controlling at the moment. It'll happen on turn 4 or turn 5. It won't happen on turn 3. Like, yeah.
So as an example, when I sit down to play against our buddy Ian, or even Kelly when he was playing Rocco, I'm not as fast as those two decks. So I'm going to mulligan for a Dranith Magistrate and a Collector Roof to ensure that their rocks and their rituals don't get to explode before then I can turn around and cast my food chain and my deafening silence and go one turn later.
Yeah. It like that is such great like acknowledgement of, in you have the experience to know that like that's like if you haven't played against these players before, right? It's, you probably get a generalized idea of the pace of a deck based on the commander. I think that's why I like playing the commanders that I currently play, like Helga or Shalayan Halar, are two of my favorites. But like, it's because when I put them in the command zone, nobody knows the pace. So it's hard for them to, it's designed for them to make a poor decision to give me like the advantage on that. Like, I know I am the aggressor, you know, and Helga, I know I am the control. So, yeah, no, that's like, you know, after talking to Ian, I know Ian is going for the, like, he's aggressive in his build. So
overtly aggressive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but he knows he needs to get ahead of, he needs to pace himself with a Rog'Sai mentality.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a crazy mm-hmm. thought. Pace yourself with a Rog'Sai mentality, because it's almost like an oxymoron. It's like,
because there is no pace to it.
Yeah, there's no pace. It is either 100 miles an hour, and then it can change, and you're all of a sudden like dead in the water, and then you draw the right card, and you're right back to 100 miles an hour. So yeah, that's got to be a roller coaster ride emotionally.
Sure. Yeah. I'll say, I think then also keeping up that pace across 5-6 rounds of Swiss and Ooh. Then an unlimited semi and an unlimited final. That's wild.
It's exhausting. It's why,
yeah,
it's why I've always been like, you know, an advocate. Like when you go to a tournament or you go to a turn, like you're sitting there between rounds talking to people about your experience, go get a snack, go eat something, go drink some water. Like it is exhausting. It is like the whole experience, your brain needs fuel, and like the amount of stress you feel in those moments. I know that like in the moments where I feel like I have a win attempt about to land, or like my heart starts going crazy. Like,
well, so here's a hot take also with the tournament structure. Why are our semis and our finals matches untimed? We are doing timed Swiss, but then a totally different style of Magic in the top 16, top 4. Shouldn't they also be timed rounds to maintain the same level of play? Because by the time we've gotten to unlimited time, I can pivot how my deck plays. And yes, there's skill to be able to do that, but we have two different types of formats in one sitting.
I will say, like, because I've had recent experience with this in not just Magic, but I'm a coach for flag football for kids. And when it comes down, like the regular season, halves are like 20 minutes. But when they get in the playoffs, they shorten them to 12 minutes. And then Whoa. Yeah, they shortened them to 12 minutes, and then the semis and the finals are back to 20 minutes. And so
why?
I don't, it's like a time thing. They want it to all like happen in a single day. Like they want the whole playoff structure to happen in one day. And it's like, no, we're, that's so crazy to me, because it's like, I've coached these kids to play a 20 minute half game. Right. And then all of a sudden I have to teach them a new format just for the, just so they can survive through the playoffs, because the same strategies that you thought would work in the first, like in the 20 minute halves, don't work in a 12 minute half, you know? So it's like, that's another thing is like Atlas, even it, I've seen him, like, it's always, I've seen him do poorly in Swiss and then just like turn it on the last couple rounds and make the cut so he can get into those untimed rounds, because that is when he is at an advantage, because that is his play style, is to like control the game and navigate all these situations with unlimited sort of like no worry, no stress for time. But I agree, it's like we should be playing the same game throughout the entire experience, because we're trying to prove who's the best at this thing,
at this specific thing, and yes, where we could push positive affect change again in this tournament structure is the win versus draw versus intentional or IDs, right?
Yep.
If I know that when this game comes to time, my Swiss points will matter, you're going to get less IDs at rounds 5 and 6. Players will fully play out to the end. And they will want to be first out of Swiss, not just for the bye, but to go to time and play it out in the semis and the finals. And say what we will about fairness, but you've proved your mettle after 6 full rounds in some kind of silver or gold event. Great. You've now deserved that undefeated status that you left Swiss with.
Yep. And at time at the final table, if you made it through the semis, you know, like highest ranked player at the end of time should be awarded. Like you've spent all day earning that. Like,
correct.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. That was one change that I saw like pitched after the 11 hour game that I was like, I was like, I don't know if I want to like give a player an alternate win con. But I do think in tandem with the whole 3 timeouts style of play that, that like inserting a token to like redeeming a token stops the clock. Right. So it's like the clock doesn't keep rolling. You get to insert yourself timeout. Let's talk about this. Boom, boom, boom. But I think that, those in tandem makes for a very powerful, like effective rule structure for time, like for the sake of every player's time, for the sake of expectations for every player. That's also like a big aspect of it too, is like there have been times where we'll be finished with a round of Swiss, and because they have one table has to finish the turn to be able to determine if it's a draw or who wins. It's like, I've stood around for 45 minutes. I want to know when round one ends. I want to know when round two begins so that I have an, like, okay, round one starts at noon. Round two starts at 1:20 or 1:25,
correct,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so like, if our game finishes in 20 minutes, I want to know that I can walk away, go get a snack or go to the car, whatever, and then come back. And at 1:25, round two will fire. Like, that should be the structure of all of these tournaments. You know that the final game is going to fire at 5:00. Boom. I can now, as an audience, as like a player who got knocked out early, I know I can leave and come back and support my buddy who made it to the final table at 5:00. I can come back. I can see who is the overall winner of this tournament will be. And then at 6:30, a winner will have been decided. What is so hard about that?
That is a very hot take that some players will vehemently disagree with us with. but I am fully on board with that.
Those are control freaks.
your store employees know when they can go on their breaks, when they can go home for the night. The store owners know exactly when things are happening. It just absolutely grates on me when cradles are up for grabs and then we can't play for it because the shop has to shut down because no employee wants to work overtime that day. And I don't blame them. They should have a proper work-life balance. They're not choosing to participate in this tournament. I am. My life shouldn't affect what they're doing. But you promised me a cradle, not store credit.
Yeah. Also, like, for how much we talk about LGS's closing or how much LGS's struggle and stuff like that, you're telling me that your selfish desire for whatever prize pool is available is greater than your LGS existing. Because if you are not able, like, as a business, if you cannot iron out what hours are, like, you can give your employees or whatever, and then all of a sudden you're unexpectedly paying them overtime and it's accruing, like, because some guy wants to to talk politics at the table to, like, get his way to earn the prize that you're offering. Like, no, at that point, it actually becomes a pretty massive loss for the LGS and for the TOs because they have to pay someone to stay there while you bicker and argue about someone resolving a smothering tithe. So, like, that, like, no, like, get the, like, get the time structure figured out, and then, like, your LGSs or your TOs can then find a venue where the time slot is available. It'll be, you know, games start at 10, finals at 5. Boom. We'll pay people for that amount of time. If it goes beyond that time, like, it won't, because the structure is there. There is a roadblock at the end of that six o'clock or 6:30. Everyone out. That's when we have the venue for. That's how much we expected to spend to pay our employees to be here for this. We're not paying them overtime. So get your prizes. You placed first in Swiss. Congratulations. You have won the guy's final.
I also firmly believe, another hot take, all gold events, 64 plus players, should be 2 days. We should not be doing 7 rounds of Swiss and then into untimed semis and finals. We're going to go into a 14-hour day. I would rather watch an ultra exciting game where everybody's fully alert, fully fed, fully slept.
Yep.
Starting the next day at 11 a.m. Make it a Saturday, Sunday event.
They do that with every other format.
Yes, correct. They do.
Yeah.
And in every other sport too.
That's what I was just going to say that. It's like, we have to look at CDH or TDH like it's a sport because you are there competing. That is, for me, the ultimate definition of what a sport is. Are you competing to prove that you are the best in the room at that time? Congratulations, you are sporting. Like, that is a sporting activity. So, like, yeah, we need the rule structure in place to create a sports culture for TDH. And, like, this, people understand what they're signing up for and respect each other's time and know what's at stake from the moment they, you know, submit their entry fee, essentially, right? That the rules will be enforced. These are the rules, blah, this, blah, that. Wizards of the Coast needs to have that locked in before they can actually start really monetizing and advertising this whole TDH thing. So, like, yeah, like, I, in the untimed stuff, it's like, there was, like, in baseball, it's the most insane thing. And yes, people will tell stories about it for years, just like they're going to tell stories about the 11-hour game for such a long time. But, like, a couple years ago in Seattle, the Mariners went to, I can't remember, it was like 22 innings.
Correct.
And it was like,
both pitchers were pitching lights out.
Yep. And it just, like, nobody could score a run after the ninth inning. Nobody could score a run. Went 22 innings. And it was like almost 2 o'clock in the morning. And finally, someone scored and the game ended. I'm surprised they just didn't like call it and be like, yeah, this is the first tie in MLB history. But they have it so it's that you can't tie. So it's like someone has to win, someone has to lose. And like, kudos to all the players for being competitive, remaining competitive and playing all night. But like, the amount of people who left after like the 14th inning, it's just like, yeah, oh, I've had enough. Like, I actually don't need to see how this unfolds. And then like the people who said they stuck it out and they watched the whole thing, they were there until the end of the 22nd inning. Like, okay, well, that, why are you flexing about that? Like, I don't get it. Like, you could have been sleeping, you could have been doing anything else. You had 9 hours of additional time that you just decided to spend at the ballpark, and they shut down the bar at the seventh inning. So it's like, there's no drinking and there's no additional, like, you can't there's no food, there's no water, like, no drink or anything like that past the seventh inning. So like, you're literally just locked in. You're like, yep, I am here for this.
There we go.
Yep, I am in. And that is just, at the end of the day, you can combat this opinion if you want in the comment section. I just don't think that's right, especially for this new structure that we're sort of like pitching at the moment. It's like, no, this is sport. And like, yes, at the end of the second overtime in football, it's a tie. It's a tie. No one wants to be there. They're paying people to be there, right? So the more time that they're there, the more money it costs them. Simple capitalism.
I have one more competitive question for you.
Yes.
We had pseudo touched on it on breaking up the meta. Given that this is a competitive event and everybody wants to win, at what point would you, Menace, bring a deck that's fully untried, untested, versus I'm going to, where is your prize threshold, dollar threshold, player threshold to say, I know that this deck can win, I know it's in and outs, I'll be taking it to this level, versus, yeah, 15 players, that seems great, I'll try this out.
Oh, I would say, ooh, that's a tough one. At, yeah, if it's like 16 players or whatever, and there's one cut to top four, I'm willing to take pretty much anything. Like,
okay,
I think I would take the Indoraptor deck that I built. It has no control elements, as it has very seldom interaction to it, but there's just a chance that a Hail Mary falls to me and I'm winning a game, you know? And then, I would say that I want to know my lines, like the back of my hand, as soon as I go into anything more than, I don't know if it would be 32 or like 40 plus, you know, like, or 44 plus or 48.
So if we're guaranteed a top 16, cut to top 16,
I would,
then you want.
Yes. Yeah. If there's a top 16 cut, I want to play the deck that I know the best.
Yeah, this is a debate that I've had with Kevin again recently, where which partner pairings would potentially be good, and at what point do we take something different to these types of events? We started potentially brewing a Silas Ren Kodama deck to see if we could get infinite landfall ETBs in Sultai, and it took some doing. We're not saying the deck is good, but give a competently skilled pilot who loves that color pie and let them test it, but while also chasing their ELO to get an invite at the end of the year, I just don't know if we're going to find those types of players.
Yeah, no, they're like I was saying before, there are those players look at win percentages, and then they look at those decks before they even look at any fun, crazy Rube Goldberg machine that could potentially win, right? Like, that's I am one of those players, right? Like, that's what I was saying. Like, when I take Shalai and Hilar or Helga, I go with those decks because the pace of those decks is unknown to other players, and it gives me what I feel is an advantage, where those other players who are chasing the ELO and chasing invites, they're going to play the decks with the highest win percentage, study those lines, goldfish 1,000 times a day, you know, and then also play whenever they can. Like those, I guess, I think it's, they're obviously everyone's has their own style and play and like opinions about this, but I do think you could put a, you know, separate, you know, between like, hey, people who are willing to play Rube Goldberg machines and people who are not. And two types of people in this world, right?
Yeah,
I would play the Sultai Landfall thing in a heartbeat because I've seen the Kodama Sakashima deck. Like,
sure,
that was fun. That was crazy when it, you know, and it was like surprisingly effective. I saw a Garuda deck get played not too long ago, or it was at MagicCon in Chicago, I think.
Oh, and nice.
I was like, they resolved Garuda and the game ended because it was just Garuda. Oh, yeah. It was like Itali, essentially, right?
All Garudas and clones.
All the 4-mana clones. Boom, 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 yeah. Boom. You know, until you hit your win condition.
How about this? I'll send you the list. We think we've got it down to like 102 cards. Feel free. Print it. Proxy it up. Test it. See what it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm currently in this like deck building, like I wouldn't say a funk, but I'm in sort of a renaissance in how I think about Magic at the moment, based on like all of these new cards that are rapidly, you know, be rapid fired into the format, into the card pool. It's like, I think I need to like the strategies that I have used in the past are good, but I think like there's a change that needs to happen if I want to be able to take advantage of, you know, like that off kilter, off axis, pace disruption style of play that I'm going for.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like in the last episode, I talked about Marith. I really like Marith. I think Marith might be a fun deck to play around with plus one counters and crazy card advantage engines like Terra Symbiosis. Because I think that alone could, those two could be, that is a competitive level of, if you're able to create Naya control synergies, those two together can create enough card draw to give you a chance like that. And then you also have known Marith combo lines. Like that is a CDH deck from, like, it's an old list, but it checks out. Like that is kind of like it can do stuff at the table. You know, it can freely, as long as you have the mana available, it can freely throw damage anywhere on the table. It can knock out planeswalkers, kill a Drannith, whatever, you know. So it can do a lot. And maybe, you know, I would love to see the list, because then maybe I can take my newfangled method of thinking and brewing and help you figure out what your 100 is, what your, you know, that way. Yeah.
It would be fun to play this at a bronze. I will say that.
Yeah. Oh, dude, that's the thing. You play it at a bronze level event. I'll take anything. There's the Indoraptor. There are kooky lines in that with like Goblin Sharpshooter that I'm like, yeah, I'm going to ping the Raptor. And you either sacrifice your whole board and then I just keep untapping the Goblin Sharpshooter, or you just take the damage straight to your face. It's like, it's pretty great, you know, but it's like those things are Christmas land in a CDH event. It's like I'm doing it for the memes almost.
That's why we just keep playing and keep grinding.
Yeah, you learn how effectively and how consistently you can land those things. Like I did play the Indoraptor deck at MagicCon in Vegas that same this last year, and it was like people were wondering if I was ever even going to cast the Indoraptor because of the level of interaction I had like in the deck. So I had a few cards for interaction, and I had a few, like I had Obnixilis, Captive Kingpin in my hand, and my next top deck was like an all will be one. So I landed the Obnixilis. I watched as it went around. It got a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. And then the next turn, people are like, did you even build an Indoraptor deck? It just looks like you're playing Jund good stuff. And I'm like, if I play All Will Be One and then cast the Indoraptor, the Indoraptor enters with that many counters and it deals that damage to any target. So it's honestly pretty good. Like, it's just a good...
The win con itself.
It's just an alternate... It just happens to be an alternate combo machine with Obnixilis, which I fell into. So, like... how effectively can I get to those lines? How consistently? And that's like part of the deck building process, is like playing those kooky lines and then ultimately cutting the fat away so that I can include either card draw or interaction so that it becomes this hyper effective. Yeah. Walk that line. That's what we're going for. How you navigate the game. That's all comes down to the pilot. So yeah, the Kodama Silas, it does sound crazy to me. It does sound a little crazy. Are you playing like artifact synergies with Silas Red, or is it just there for the colors?
No, Cloudstone Curio's in there for a reason.
Okay.
Good. So Silas actually matters this time too.
Yeah, rarely he rarely does.
Correct. So it's one of those, we're down bad, we're playing Silas. No, I want that artifact recursion. And we'll see how this goes. There's some old school commons in here that, I've never heard of that. It's great.
Yeah. And they look at it, they see it on the stack and they let it resolve and you go, you fool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Priority. You've spelled your doom, my
excellent
friend.
For me, it's Cinder Vines. Whenever Cinder Vines resolves, I go, excellent. My game plan is online. One last question before I get out of here.
Sure.
You know, quick spitballing on it. Recently, Mark Rosewater has come under fire, right? For, the spoiling of the Spider-Man set. Because this is a standard legal set, and everyone is expecting it to have 276 cards, however big a set is, but it's not. It's Assassin's Creed size. And he was on his blog at Tog answering a bunch of questions the other day and said that they're switching to a structure where it's a set every 2 months with four large releases like Edge of Eternities and of the like. But then in between, you're going to get little supplementary sets that are Universes Beyond or Aftermath style things.
Sure.
Do you think that
this is nothing new? We had that for the old blocks where you'd get a major set and then supplement sets after that. Urza's block was the great example of that. The first Urza set was much bigger than the other two.
Right, but it was just less frequent than it is now.
That part is disheartening because of the product fatigue, but I have nothing against it. It is what it is. It should be. I really like when they bring in a new mechanic and explore it 2 to 3 times.
Absolutely.
None of this, hey, I want to go back to Ikoria. I loved Mutate. We got nothing else. So all these cards that say when you mutate, do a thing are actively useless.
Yep. And we're going to get the same thing. I think that's why they, like in Edge of Eternities, this whole like void effect,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes.
It says whenever a non-token permanent or whatever leaves a battle, or non-land permanent leaves a battlefield.
Non-land permanent.
Or you warped a card this turn, then you get this effect. And it's like they're hedging their bets, you know, or they're protecting themselves by creating like meaningless cards, right? Because if it just said if you had warped a card this turn, get the void effect, then after the set, you know, after we identify what cards are worth playing that have warp on them, all the other those cards just become dead. They become literally just like chaff thrown into the bin, forever forgotten about.
Yes.
Yeah. So like, so
I think
like foretell
fine cutting these down. I don't think it's worth the amount of grief that I saw in these articles. They actually increased the size of the set, according to one of the articles that I read by him. So do we want a 250, 300 set card with characters from the Spider-Man universe that appeared in one comic? Or do we want it boiled down to something very high-end, very tasty, like a roux?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's ultimately what I would like is... honestly, Aftermath is a set I keep going back to and being like, wow, there were some bangers there.
Correct.
Like, yeah, like Itali, you know, being a banger. You know,
Sigarda.
Yeah, Sigarda. Kallax being a banger. Like, there are all these cards that I still want to play or still build around because of how, I don't know, like, it was a supplementary set. It was great. It didn't get great reception because the pack sizes were so small. That's pretty much it. People didn't feel like they were getting their value for five. It was like five or seven cards. I can't remember, but
it was. But your rarity, they had less commons and uncommons in them.
Yeah,
you got like, more rares out of them.
Yeah, it was like two rares a pack. So, yeah. Ultimately, I would like slower releases. Like the product fatigue is so real. And if you don't have like. I don't know. If you don't have the ability to turn on blinders as a content creator, I don't. I don't have the ability to put up blinders on for this. Like, I have to see it all because I want to be talking about these things. I want to, you know. So, like, all the Spider-Man releases, the Avatar stuff and all that, I have, my media streams are just full of that. So it can be exhausting at times. But, like, yeah, I like slowing the pace down a little bit would be nice. It's nice when we have like a 2 or 3 week break before new spoilers start coming out. But
I just don't think it's possible to get through all of these cards and find these new things when we have so many cards coming out.
I can't even test them. I can't even test these cards because by the time I've tested them, there's something that has come out that has surpassed it.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, that was the last thing I wanted to bring up. See how you felt about that. Yeah. Any final thoughts on today's discussion?
If you're getting into CEDH, make sure you're asking the questions, the why. If you're brand new to a tournament, don't be afraid to call for a judge. And all of these top tier, top 25 players, they'd love to say hi to you. Go ask them questions, play a game, ask them what their deck does outside of the game, and pick their brains.
If they're mean to you, then they're not cool.
Lastly, don't lie. Don't be that person.
That's a
lose
big
games
one.
With integrity. That's better than needing the points.
Exactly. Like, honesty is going to be the way that you continue to grow within the community. Because these are players that you will see again. Like, I promise you. Like, when you get out of your shell and you start going to these tournaments, you realize, yeah, the world is big, but it's also really small in some ways. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna see these players again. And if you are a known liar, no one will want to play with you. And then you will see people talking about you and being like, yeah, that dude's a liar. He lied to me 3 months ago. And then... I never forgot about it.
I will say my last statement, I have seen a positive change where people are getting publicly called out for it.
Hell yeah. Shame. Yeah. Like, it's the way it should be. If you want to instill any type of culture or promote it or keep it, the integrity of it alive, then you need to call out, like, you need to call out liars. You need to call out cheaters. And really just having your nose rubbed in it, right? You should just know after you get your nose rubbed in it, you're not supposed to do that. If you want to be a part of that culture, then don't be a liar. Don't be a cheater. Don't act with integrity. So I will say that
Naya guys don't lie.
Naya guys don't lie. That's the next hat that we're making. I will say it's served me very well in life to be genuine and honest, and it has never benefited me. I've actually felt worse about like knowingly lying about something, and it eats me up like crazy. So it's just better overall. Be honest, be genuine, And yeah, be a good dude. That's it. That's it.
Correct.
All right. This has been another episode of the Mock Stars podcast. Thank you all for tuning in, checking us out, and sticking around for this lengthy discussion. We may have rambled a little bit at points, but it was necessary. Absolutely necessary. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by finding us on YouTube, where you can like, subscribe, and ring that bell for notifications. Support us there. We're at 565 subscribers, and you know what it is. Once we hit 600, it's an immediate jump to 1,000. So help us get to 600. That way we can take that leap to 1,000. You know, it's numbers 7, 8, 900 don't exist. So now we can, yeah. Anyway. You can also support us on all major podcasting platforms or minor podcasting platforms, pretty much any podcasting platform. Leave us a 5-star review, make us look super duper cool. And you can also support us on Patreon by becoming an official Pepperhead. Support the show for $3 a month. Have your name turned Dr. Pepper Red on the Discord server. All right. We're out of here. Peace.
Peace.